Samora Lorenzo has joined us today to talk about refugee voting in Bosnia. Welcome, and thank you very much for speaking with Innovations for Successful Societies. I wonder if you would first tell us about the position you held when you first became involved in introducing refugee voting in Bosnia, and perhaps talk also about what brought you to this job.
I was brought to the job by an internship at something which still exists in Vienna, Austria, called the International Center for Migration Policy Development, which was founded by a former high-ranking Swedish immigration official and refugee policy official named Jonas Widgren, who's since died. And it was designed, ICMPD was designed to coordinate, harmonize migration policies between new member states of the EU and the existing ones. By a long series of coincidences, which are not so important here, the offices of ICMPD became the secretariat for the refugee elections component of the first Bosnian elections in 1996. And I was around the office, and as the kind of crises multiplied in the effort to implement the refugee voting mandate, I made myself more and more useful, and by the end was a member of this steering group, very improbably. But it started in earnest around May of 1996. It had always been foreseen that refugees would be able to participate in the election. The elections were not run by the UN because there just wasn't very much confidence in the UN in general in that region at the time, and so the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, was given the mandate. I don't know that they had organized elections before. They had help, technical help from IFES and Elections Canada, but naturally everyone's focus and attention and priority was on the voting process within Bosnia. And the staff were in Sarajevo. There were no flights to Sarajevo. There was one sort of Swiss plane that went back and forth. It was difficult to get there. The phones didn't work. And so there was a woman, I think her name was Judy, this was one of her duties, but had fallen by the wayside until around June. The elections, I think, were in October, September. See how dates are. That's an important one. But, we didn't have much time to find all these people, register them, and so forth. And so a bit of panic set in, and what happened was the Swiss government were serving as the chairman in office of the OSCE that year. The chairmanship of the OSCE rotates around Europe every year to a different foreign minister. And so Switzerland was in the chair that year, which was fortunate because they have extra cash at their disposal. And when this problem was brought to light, the Swiss recruited a Swiss general named Peter Arbenz, who had headed the Swiss Refugee Agency and had been the inspector general of IFOR forces in Bosnia when the war was still going on. It was one of Switzerland's first deployments of a soldier in a combat situation since the Middle Ages or something. So he was asked to create a task force under OSCE auspices, but separate from the OSCE structure because it was too overburdened, just to do what he could with the time remaining to enable refugees to vote. And we were given $2 million in a numbered bank account in Austria with which to do this. So we were in the ICMPD office because it was the summer, and so Jonas went on vacation and said, you guys can just stay and you can have Mauro to help. He speaks German because I've been exchanged and he speaks French, and he's good with computers and so forth. So I was just part of the furniture. It got started. Arbenz recruited some Swiss kind of diplomat types to go and make arrangements with the other European host countries. But the smartest thing they did was to recruit, to make a partnership with IOM, the International Organization for Migration, to sort of second a senior officer to run this. And the guy who really ran it under Arbenz's authority was his name Bill Hyde, who you should interview as well. He's was the coordinator for emergency situations at IOM for many years. Didn't have elections experience, but had a lot of experience like running big complicated things with migrants in disordered places on a tight time frame. And he's American, and you know, we formed a bond, and I guess it really started when, so now we get into some of the operational details which made this challenging. I feel like I've maybe skipped over some other things in doing this, but if there were details, you can remind me to about how I got there, remind me to go back to them. There was the electoral law that was agreed for the election was based on the last Yugoslav census, which had been done, I believe, in 89 or 90, like right before the war started. And so that seemed to be good because it was not tainted by the politics of the war, per se. It had been done relatively recently, so it would probably capture most of the people you would want to vote. And it had been done at a time when there was some computerization, so it existed on microfilm or something. And so they, in Sarajevo, had managed to put it onto computers. And so when we came onto the radar of the elections people in Sarajevo, they said, oh, okay, we'll send you one of these computers or a bunch of them. So we had recruited a bunch of kind of agents to be based in European capitals to run the offices and to find and register people. And so we brought them all to Vienna to give them their laptop with this very valuable database. And so Bill said, can you just sort of make sure the computers work and figure out how you search for people so that you can show them tomorrow? So I said, sure. And so I turned on the computers, and they were very kind of old and slow, and so it was taking a long time to search for anyone. But the real fatal flaw was that it was a bunch of nice, I think, American IT people sitting in Sarajevo who had designed it, and they had neglected to include a way to search for names that have diacritical marks on them. And 98% of Bosnian names have a Hacek or something on top of them. And so you could only search for, you know, people who didn't happen to have that, which rendered it almost useless. And I played with it all night, and I found, I mean, there was a way through using these wildcard things to sort of search, but you would have to replace the, you know, you'd have to know what you were looking for to be able to find it. And in many cases, you wouldn't. And there was no way we were going to be able to register 500 people by the deadline, much less, you know, the millions of Bosnians outside the country. And we were really run as a startup. We were physically separate from the rest of the OSCE. We weren't part of their decision-making structures. If we thought it made sense to do something, we had the money, and they thought we just did it. And so I think I went and found some computer guy who claimed he could, you know, reformat it in a way that it was searchable. He did that. That took about a week of time we didn't have. And he brought us back something which was still clunky, but actually, you could actually search for people who did it. And so that people that, you know, made me a little bit, showed I could be a little bit useful in this. And so they just asked me to hang around, and I eventually became Bill's sort of like main assistant or deputy in Vienna. And because what happened, as we'll get to, is once we sort of unilaterally removed a few of the chief obstacles to refugees being able to register, the flood began on a scale that none of us ever imagined. Hundreds of thousands of people registering to vote, which then presented the related problem, which we eventually got to, of how do you print enough ballots, get them to them, and get them back by the deadline. And we'll just take you through later just the logistics of what we had to deal with and some of the little crises that came up. And so that was the base, that was the structure of it. And that's, I think, one reason why the efforts of this unit have never been part of the main story of what happened during those elections, because it was done, everyone in Sarajevo, the decision makers in Sarajevo knew about it, but it just wasn't part of what they were thinking. And they didn't want, the whole point was that they didn't want to have to worry about it because they were so concerned about the integrity and peacefulness of the vote inside Bosnia. They just like, they wanted to be able to say, we made an effort to enable refugees to vote. They didn't care. They weren't pressuring us to, you got to get 200,000 or 50,000. They didn't care. It was just they needed to be able to say they'd done it. And in fact, I think our success was in many ways inconvenient because it hadn't been planned for. For example, the counting mechanisms, which we'll get to, hadn't taken account that there would be tons and tons of paper ballots coming from abroad. That was their problem, not our problem. Here's the quirk in the Bosnian election law which caused us a lot of trouble, everyone a lot of trouble, because when I say it was inconvenient for them, it was. If I give you the punchline of the story, as a result of what happened in the refugee voting process, because of the loopholes in the electoral law that had been negotiated, I guess as part of Dayton or shortly afterwards. A situation arose that caused the head of the OSCE, just a week before the elections, it must have been October of 96, to cancel the local and municipal elections, to only allow the presidential elections to go forward. And I'll explain why. So what I think for everyone was just like a box to be checked, ended up having that consequence, which freaked the United States out like you can't believe, because think back to 96, there was U.S. presidential election the next month. There was a lot of uncertainty about whether American forces should be in Bosnia, and it was very important to say, no, they're just there for this defined mission. Success is happening. They're going to be home soon. And when you have very publicly two-thirds of the election being called off at the last minute, it was an unwelcome development. But more to the point, and this is why I think including refugees in elections is so important, it changed the outcome. Because, and this is what you find in every refugee situation, refugees are not a representative sample of the country they fled from. They're not victims of an earthquake. They're people who were targeted for one reason or another and either pushed out or induced to flee. In the case of Bosnia, the majority of refugees were Muslim. There was a big concentration of Bosnian Serb refugees in Serbia. We could never tell how many of those were actually Bosnian Serbs, how many were Serbs who Serbia got to register, which is part of the problem we'll get to later on. But if you fail to include refugees in a vote, in this first post-conflict vote, you're entrenching, you could entrench ethnic cleansing, you could just create a situation which makes it undesirable or impossible for them to even consider returning home. And the election, in a cruel way, can become, can seal the victory of the people who were the most aggressive during a conflict. Which is why I'm surprised that even today it's just not seen as an essential, non-negotiable piece of any post-conflict election strategy. And what happened was most of the Bosnian voters voted for Izetbegović, Alija Izetbegović, not for the Serb or the Croatian candidate. And that margin is what enabled Izetbegović to cross the threshold to be the chairman of the tripartite presidency. It's counterfactual history, but I think that I remember it was generally felt, there was relief at that, because it was hard to see how this could hold if he wasn't, I don't know that it gave him much more power, it was designed as a pretty diffuse structure, but if he hadn't emerged from that, would the implementation of the Dayton Accords have been as relatively smooth as it has been since then, I don't know. Anyhow, back to the thing. So the problem with the electoral law was that it enabled you to vote where you currently lived, which seems normal. And Bosnia is divided up into 60 or 70 sort of counties called them. They're called opština, but it's like a little local government unit. Underneath there are cities and towns, and above that is they created these cantons and then the national government. But the real unit for electoral purposes is this opština. And the ballot for the opština can be very different. And so the logistics of printing 70 or 80 versions of the ballot were overwhelming because each option had its own negotiated relationship either with the Federation of Bosnia-Herzegovina it was very, very complicated. And Mostar had its own ballots and all these contested places. So you could register to vote where you currently lived. You could register to vote where you lived before the war, again, as an effort to not, to give people a way to reverse through the ballot box ethnic cleansing, or at least prevent it from being legitimized through an election. And the third option, which is the one which I think has been never seen before or since in comparative electoral law, which was that you could vote where you intended to live in the future. Right? And so there was some vague language that you should document this somehow. But it wasn't clear that there was any, that we had a right to refuse it. If a signed declaration stating this intent, you kind of had to accept that as evidence of their intention to live there in the future. So a refugee in Bosnia, a Bosnian refugee in Germany, who before the war had lived in Mostar, could say, when I go home, I intend to live in Sarajevo, and he would receive a ballot for Sarajevo and vote there. I don't know the details of why this became part of the compromise, but it was a giant loophole through which the Serbian government especially tried to drive a big truck, and I'll explain that at the end. There was another complication which we faced. We actually faced that before this one, and it was purely sort of logistics and about paper and things. The electoral law said that each registration had to be on a numbered form. So there were these forms in duplicate or triplicate, and they had a serial number on them. And for reasons of, stimulation of the local economy, it had been decreed that those forms should be printed in Sarajevo with these serial numbers. And despite, I can't tell you how many hours on the phone, faxes, I could not get, and there was only the one plane. I couldn't get anyone to send. They would send me, and I would get, 500 forms. What am I supposed to do with 500 forms? I need 100,000 forms. Maybe in 2 months. What do you mean in 2 months? Well, if the election's going to be over. But their focus, they were, the printing press had a capacity. All they cared about was having enough forms for Bosnians because that's where the cameras were going to be. If the poor Bosnians in Norway didn't get forms, not quite as crucial. So we had to make a decision at some point. I don't remember if it was in June or July. But what's more important, what's more crucial, is it that people be enfranchised and have the right to vote? If they can prove that they're otherwise entitled because they're on the census, they have other ID documents and so forth, or is it more important to, or is it better to deny people that right if we don't have enough individually numbered forms with which to register them? And we decided that it was more important that people be able to participate in the first election. And frankly, we decided that on our own, we didn't ask the OSCE, we didn't ask any lawyers, we just did it. So we photocopied the forms. And we accepted forms by fax. We accepted forms, things so you could get it and pass it, and we didn't care about the serial number anymore. We cared about, because we knew we had a way to track and keep track of whether that name had already been registered from the census. So you couldn't register three times, or at least through us. And that's what opened the floodgate. And we had, I don't think anyone had any idea of the demand there was amongst Bosnians to participate in this. We didn't have the time to do any advertising. we didn't, you know, it was just like craziness from beginning to end because this got started so late, and that's why our estimates were so high. So we took a pool, like a betting pool, when we got a few weeks after we started, like how many do you think we can register by the deadline? And I guessed 25,000. Bill, I think, guessed 35 or 40. Gerda, who was this Austrian woman who was the third sort of key person, the deputy to Bill, and she was more conservative. She guessed 15,000. Because we were looking at the rules we had to do and the time available, no way. And the end result was 685,000 people in more than, in 70, I think 74 or 75 countries and jurisdictions. I woke up, I was in the office one day early, this knock on the door, this guy with a gun, and this giant back. And I'm like, can I help you? And he comes in, he is the Bosnian ambassador to Libya. And he has come from Tripoli with like three potato sacks full of completed ballots by Bosnians living in Libya. I didn't know there were any Bosnians living in Libya. I mean, I think we knew, but we had given up. Like, there was no way. IOM didn't even have a representative there. Kiss them goodbye, they can't vote. No, how are we going to get the Bosnians in Libya to vote? But he heard about it. He got his copy of the form, and then he organized at their mission, and they all came, and they filled it out correctly. And I remember almost all of those ballots checked out, and they were able to vote. So community leaders did it. I mean, it just happened on its own without us having, just because people needed to participate in ways that none of us had realized or imagined. I got ballots from French Polynesia, places where, you know, who knew there were Bosnians there? All over Latin America and so forth. So registered these. By that time, we had created more sophisticated IT infrastructure, again, totally separate and independent of the OSCE, because I had to replicate this database in all of the countries where we had field missions, and then we set up a central one in Vienna in rooms next to us, and we just recruited dozens of Austrian college students, basically, to check the things. So we handled all of these other countries and jurisdictions. It came to Vienna, and so our fax machine was just running all day, all weekend. We felt we had a duty, like if people had gone through that trouble, like we had to just work nonstop until there was literally no more time. And the time, unfortunately, cuts off. And there were a lot of people who didn't get to vote because, there may have been an official deadline, but the real deadline was related to the printing press. And I started to spend a lot of time with the Austrian state printer because, thank God, Sarajevo realized that this little printer there couldn't handle these ballots. And so they contracted with the Austrian state printer to actually print the ballots because it's, you know, it was so mathematically complex and so forth, because there's 87 counties and et cetera. And so I have to like get in there to like, because they don't know we exist. What do you mean? Who are you? Like refugee ballots? I'm dealing with Sarajevo. No, these are top secret. I can't give you these ballots. I'm like, no, really. I need about 600,000 of them. No, impossible. There's no more paper that's red, and we have to, there's no way. And so you just sort of like be persistent and sweet, but not go away, because after all of this, what am I like? Now I'm going to like say, oh, sorry, like you can't vote because we don't have enough ballots to send you. So through many forms of pressure, we got them to ramp up production and have enough for us. And we then faced with the challenge of how do you get them to people? We had our offices in European countries, and so we could send a bulk there and some people could come to the office, some people would be mailed. And so we decided, again, on our own, without asking headquarters and without worrying too much about it, because we were just focused on the deadlines, that we would accept that the ballots could be, we could mail them to people, and we would accept their ballots back by mail. So, and I think this was a thing where it wasn't expressly forbidden by the electoral law, but not clearly permitted either. But then, like, how do you even, like, we're going to send them to our address? We'll fill the entire office from floor to ceiling. And so then we basically called DHL and asked them, said, you know, like, we have this problem. And DHL, we're very good. I mean, it's just like, you know, a reminder of why it's sometimes best to work with private companies who know how to do, for whom this was not that big of a task in the grand scheme of things. And so they designed a system. So we would send people the ballot with a prepaid DHL envelope prepinned with the address to send back to us. Because we knew, like, if you ask people to, like, figure out what address to send it to and then write it out and then go to the DHL office, you would lose half of them. And again, like, for us, it was just like, and we paid for it, and we had, you know, the Swiss had given us this money, and so it's to be used to help people vote, so we decided to pay for the return thing and DHL's thing. And DHL then created this address, and as the ballots came back, they were put in a warehouse at Vienna Airport, and we asked the Austrian Interior Ministry to put, you know, men with machine guns around it, so they were, no one knew or cared, but we made sure that there was that kind of security from beginning to end once it had entered DHL's custody. DHL, despite its vast, they could even send them to Libya. Then that's what really sold me, is when they could deliver the Libyan ballots. They could not, however, deliver even a postcard to Sarajevo. No. So I'll never forget this day. So the three of us went out, like, on basically when everything was back to see. And it was just like, it's one of these things where, like, you work and work and work, and you're just like, there's papers and faxes and conversations, and it all feels very kind of, you know, ethereal, like, is there anything real happening? And you go there, and they took us to the place, and it was like, you know like those things where they have salt for the roads in the winter, those little silos on the turnpike? It was like that. It was that big. It was like you couldn't climb to the top of it. Just ballots from top, like people actually, you know, doing something they wouldn't have been able to do unless we broke the rules or invented the rules as we went, unless we didn't worry too much about, you know, because if we had even started the conversation, by the time they sort of thought about it, the election would have happened, and they wouldn't have cared. They wouldn't have cared because, you know, the success was going to be judged by what happened in Bosnia, even if the election in Bosnia couldn't actually be fully successful unless the refugees voted in significant numbers. So it was like 18-hour days, but just minute after minute, like innumerable, like, little problems, like, you know, to the, like, I had these, it was decided at one point that the refugee voting should also be observed. There should also be observers of refugee voting. So I had debates with them. I'm like, what do you want to observe in people receiving an envelope in the mail, and that you're going to go house to house and observe them? What do you mean observe? There were some places where there was high enough concentrations of people where we ran our own polling stations. So it wasn't all by mail. In Croatia, in Turkey, strangely, Slovakia, so there were things for observer in Serbia too. So there were things for observers to observe. And so eventually, so we said, fine, okay, we'll do the observers. And so they said, okay, you have, so I just got this list of names of like 40 people from OSCE Central. Like, okay, these have been assigned to you. And here I am, like, well, I won't tell you at the end how old I was. So I got this list, and these are all like experienced people, like eager. And so I have to decide where they go. And so the first way to decide is like, okay, all Italians go to Serbia because they didn't need visas for Serbia. And I was tired of going to the Serbian embassy to negotiate for visas. So Italians all go to Serbia. And then I just parceled the others up randomly in little teams. And then they came to Vienna, and we talked to them a little bit, and I was like, you know, it may not be exactly quite as dramatic as in other places, but there's still important issues which could arise, and keep your eyes open and so forth. But it was everything just like dated, and then I had to go finally get the visas for them and explain, and so it's just like problems. And all of it, as I said at the beginning, it's impossible to even conceive of now, but we did it all without email or cell phones. I sent from my own account, which I could use Telnet to get to. Anyone remember Telnet? I would write home and to friends and stuff, but never once did I use it for actually speeding up anything or coordinating anything related to the election. It was entirely done by telephone and fax. Maybe one of the last large-scale such operations to be done in Europe without using email at all. And you know what? It worked just fine in a way, because since I was on the phone talking to everyone every day, and since people actually answered their phones, and since when they answered their phones, since you had already talked three times that day, you didn't have to say, oh, how are you, and waste time. It was just like, okay, do the, no. And so it was very efficient, and we didn't even have speed dial. You just had to memorize everyone's number. And it worked well enough. But like when I had to go like to the airport or the printer, like no one could, there's no way to find me until I happened to come back. And often there were questions that only I knew the answer to, and the other ones that only Gerda knew the answer to, and so forth. Because amongst other things, and this is what we'll get to, one of my main jobs toward the end was maintaining this spreadsheet. Because as I said, the ballots were really complicated. And so I had to, as they were coming in, as the registrations were coming in, I had to be sort of in real time updating the information for the printer because otherwise they would run out of time because they had to reset the whole system to run an Opshchina's ballots. So if I needed all of a sudden 3,000 extra copies of the ballot from Mostar, they had to like stop the press, recalibrate everything, it was a big undertaking. So they weren't just being cranky when they were telling us it was impossible. I mean, it was expensive and time-consuming. So I started to see this picture of who was registering in which Opshchina, from which country of refuge, and using, and there was the third piece of information in the spreadsheet. I still have this spreadsheet somewhere, I'll send it to you. The third piece of information, using which of the three methods of registering, so where they lived before the war, where they lived now, or where they intended to live in the future. And a pattern started to emerge that concerned me. Namely, the country actually which hosted the largest number of Bosnian refugees was Serbia, because many Serbs had been evicted from where they had lived as well. And all of them fled to Serbia. The Bosnian Muslims fled to all corners of the earth, and the Croatians fled more widely. But the Serbs were all constant. There were about, I think there were 600,000 in total, of whom, I think 200, why do I remember these numbers? This shows you how seared it gets into your brain. 285,000 of them were in Serbia. And we had this guy, what is his name? We had this guy who was half Italian, half Serb, who was our representative in Serbia. So the pattern was, if you recall, there were certain towns in Bosnia which were extremely controversial, like Brčko, Srebrenica, and a handful of others, which had large Muslim majorities before the war. They'd all been thrown out, and they were very close to Serbia, and it was hard to imagine sort of building a coherent Republika Srpska if there were these enclaves, and so they were really keen on maintaining control of them. And in those places, I started to see more people registering to vote in those towns by declaring they intended to live there in the future than had ever lived there in all of history. So you have a town that before the war had 5,000 people, and there's 50,000 people registered to vote there. So, and this kept coming, and I would, ask our guide, he's like, I don't know, that's what they're doing. And, but we didn't have many eyes or ears on the ground we later got wind of how the Serbs had done it, just sort of like, trek by bus, okay, now you're going to vote here and you're going to vote there. And people did it. So I talked to Bill. I think we probably talked to General Urbans, and we said, "Well, we have to tell Sarajevo this because this is this suggests that there's some wider plan afoot, and that's not the intention of that provision." So I wrote it up. I sent a memo, faxed it to Ambassador Froelich in Sarajevo, who I think heretofore had never had reason to take note of our existence. By the next morning, he had decided to cancel all the local and opština, all the local and the municipal and county elections. All of those people could still vote for president because it didn't matter which town you were registered in terms of the president, because you picked one of the three. And so, all of this like toil and complication with the Austrian state printer turned out to be totally in vain, because I could have just printed a single ballot for everyone saying, who do you want for president? Because everyone got a ballot for the opština, but none of that was counted. And the United States freaked out. And so the fig leaf that was invented was, okay, we're going to rerun the local and municipal elections in a month. And, first we were just like, no, it can't be. What do you mean? Because it's not this problem is deeper than that. And then we just like, look, like the Clinton administration, that's their policy, and that's what our policy is. That policy may change after November 4th or whenever, after the American election. But for the moment, that's our policy. So we ran the election. I think Arbenz eventually got the Swiss military to give us a plane to take the ballots, because there's no way these things were getting on the little, Learjet that they had being the shuttle. So the ballots got there and caused a big problem in the sense that no one was really expecting them. I'd been sending reports to HQ in Sarajevo saying, okay, like, here's how many people are registered and so forth, and I don't know what black hole they went into, but, totally dumbfounded when these planes show up with tons and tons of ballots. And they have to sort them by opština. I think I'd done this so that it was in bags or something, so it was relatively, because they had to sort them, get them to the counting places in those areas. They hadn't really factored that in terms of time and whatever. But they were eventually counted. And then the first time I ever heard of ICG, the International Crisis Group, they made their name actually in and around this election. They'd just been formed. And they still, I have to find someone there, they still trumpet this as like their first like evidence of impact. They released their like 10 or 15 year like history of ICG, and it's on the first page. And it's built on, not a lie, but just like totally misunderstanding what was going on, because they looked at the total number of ballots, looked at how many people had been registered in Bosnia, because it's the only data they had, and said, there's been some massive corruption here, because there's roughly 600,000 ballots that shouldn't be there. And the people in the Sarajevo HQ, like in the OSC, didn't even necessarily, most of them were like, yeah, that's what the hell is going on? So it was this big, so they issued this report, and and it was only like, and no one knew, it was only us who could like, no, look over here, it's because of this. But I was actually happy about it, because it proved to me that the ballots were actually counted, because we didn't have control of them once they got into Sarajevo, and so I was in a way happy that there was evidence of it. And if you just look at the pattern, Izetbegović won by, again, I think it's probably accurate to say that without that, he wouldn't have had the he wouldn't have had the tripartite presidency, and that if he hadn't, let me put it this way: who knows whether Bosnia would have been more or less politically stable? I think it probably would have delayed the rate at which Bosnian Muslims were comfortable coming home and had trust in this thing, because they didn't like fight this war and agree to this compromise so that Momcilo Krajnik or whoever could be the president of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Voila, so maybe I'll stop there, but that's what I remember in a nutshell of what we did.
This is a fascinating story and an important part of history. And I'm sure there are many more details that you're going to remember.
If Bill was here, then it would jog my memory.
If we can
maybe there's some specific things that we
yeah, have. There's some a couple of questions that I would like to put to you. First, going back to the very beginning, as I understand it, the provisions for refugee voting were in general part of the Dayton Accords of 1995, but then some of the details were worked out subsequently, and I don't know whether you were involved at all in that or whether you could speak to that at all.
That was handed to us. Mm-hmm. That was handed to us. Because we came in, again, the preparations for voting and registration in Bosnia had been underway for months and months before someone noticed that the person who was supposed to have been doing the refugee part had sort of not done it, and and this panic ensued. And that's why it's the Swiss, okay, we'll do the money, and where do we put these people? And so this ad hoc structure was created. It was called the Refugee Election Steering Group, a title that we invented, but under the mandate, under the OSCE. And the steering group had members, which were Bill Hyde, Peter Arbenz, who was this general seconded by the Swiss, and this guy, Swiss guy called Hans-Peter Kohlschütter, who's a Swiss journalist, and Hans-Peter Kleiner, who was a former Swiss diplomat, I think. So they were the steering group. At the end, so after this big thing, I thought we would have to redo the local elections in a month or 6 weeks, I guess for lack of anything better, they actually made me the country representative to Croatia, which was the biggest one. So Bill was like, just go, don't tell anyone how old you are. And so now I'm having bilateral meetings with the foreign minister of Croatia to talk about where we do it, and then we have to hire this whole team of Croatian students to redo the registrations and so forth. It's just like an industrial process. There had been a dispute in Split where they'd gotten the wrong ballot, so I had to go and rerun it there. I had to go to Turkey suddenly with a set of extra papers because the printers had sent the wrong Mostar ballots. And so, there was a riot at the polling station in Ankara, so I went and reran it again. And it was always who can go? Oh, good, you go. And in Slovakia, there was a whole thing, and there was this woman who was, it was the strangest thing. She was a Kurd who spoke English, but whose mother was Slovak. And so we had this sort of, what's that game with the telephone? So I would speak, I think I spoke in, no, she spoke German. So I spoke in German. She then translated German to Slovak. And then one of the refugees translated Slovak to Bosnian. And then back again to explain how the voting works. And so there was just a lot of little encounters like that all over Europe, in addition to stuff on the phone fixing it. I'm getting away from the question.
So just if I could clarify, so that was when they decided to redo the local elections, or was that part of that incident earlier in the process?
Going to talk to... That was earlier.
That was earlier.
That was earlier. Just the Slovak government was like, we don't really know how to explain to people what's going on. Can you send someone? Mm-hmm. And you show up and you're expecting... And it's like hundreds and hundreds of people have come to listen. Which is good for us and good to report back because, we're just sort of beavering away, not sure if anyone really cares or is noticing or if it's important to Bosnians or not. And that just sort of reinforced us in our determination to prioritize, to maximize the number of Bosnians who would be enabled to vote over formal, over having proper serial numbers and all the registration forms. But the law was a given. It had been negotiated long before through a process that was mysterious to me and I think was quickly, when the second round of Bosnian elections happened a year or 18 months later, that had been eliminated. This intent to live in the future provision had been eliminated.
The actual system then put in place for voting was essentially a mail system facilitated by DHL that you filled out an absentee ballot essentially and you sent it in.
It was a hybrid system because that was for people who were not in these main countries.
All right, that's what I was going to say. So there were polling places set up in the main countries.
In Germany, there were a lot of polling places, and we were able to use IOM's network. That was a real advantage to having Bill there and working with IOM, as we just got at our disposal IOM's infrastructure and relationships and connections, and that dramatically shortened the time it took to negotiate access, because when you're, you can't just march into Italy or Britain and start doing political activity with foreigners. And so for the any places where we wanted to have polling stations, we had to conclude an agreement. And IOM's experience and familiarity just made it that happened. We could do that in a week or two rather than in months and months.
And so people came to those polling places. Were paper ballots then shipped back to be counted centrally, or do they count them at the polling places?
No, everyone got the same. So we just, the same ballots which were mailed out in the DHL envelopes to people who were far flung were the same ones that were sent to the polling places, and we knew roughly how many they needed. And we had to design the system where, there was a security envelope, so you would vote and then seal that and then put it in the security envelope with this red thing and then in the DHL envelope. So they just did the security, and then they sent them in bulk to the same address in Vienna, and they were put on the same pile of things. So, but they didn't. People had to come in and do it.
And as you know, a number of countries are considering refugee voting right now in Africa, and undoubtedly in other places as well. And this has been a dual theme. I was very curious about the lessons from this that you might offer them. And then in a separate set of comments, perhaps you could think out loud for us a bit about the distinctions between refugee voting and diaspora voting more generally, because there's a big move now to include members of the diaspora more generally. And I wonder if any of these observations you've made are pertinent to that.
I'll start with that one because this is just a personal political view, I suppose. But I think the arguments for diaspora voting are much weaker than the arguments for refugee voting, because people in the diaspora, in a diaspora, so generally have chosen to be there. They could choose to go home if they wish. They're probably not paying taxes at home. They've chosen a life somewhere else, and their children are somewhere else. And so it's not obvious to me, as I say, a citizen who lives there, why they should have an equal voice with me and who's going to run the country. At least because diaspora people often get a little cranky when they're abroad, and they become either, some of them become these radical nationalists, or they just go off in directions which are unrelated to the currents in main currents in society. But I think for refugee voting, I think they really should be distinguished as different kinds of things, because refugee voting, it's an opportunity and a danger, because there's always a, you can't really declare a conflict over until it's been sealed by an election. Often people want to do that election fairly quickly, and if you move too hastily, you don't consider the refugee population, you risk entrenching ethnic cleansing and worse, and then making it even more hard for those people to ever go home or feel safe going home. And the other opportunity is that it's a tool. This was the ambition or part of it, which I can't say. I haven't studied enough of what happened to say whether it contributed to this. But could you actually use? Is refugee voting part of a strategy for actually reversing ethnic cleansing? So not just preventing a bad thing from happening, but it could actually cause a good thing to happen in a way which is less likely to lead to violence, right? And so I don't know the answer to that, but that was certainly part of the hope or the idealism for what we were doing and why it was important. Not the first question.
So the first question was just reflections for other countries that are now considering doing this. And so you have some reflections on the complexity of the ballot or the character of the ballot that would be germane to this.
And so for, you know, for we you know, it nearly foundered on the complexity of the balloting arrangements. And that was an artifact of the compromises and the structures that needed to be negotiated to achieve a settlement. No one at that time was thinking, and nor should they have been thinking, frankly, about, oh God, that's going to mean it's going to take 30 days to print ballots at the Austrian state printer instead of 5 days. That's not what they should have been worried about. But it had that consequence later on. And so to the extent that you can simplify just the number of different ballots that have to be printed, the greater the margin of error you have when inevitably things go way wrong and you have deadlines and fewer people get disenfranchised because more of them will have gotten the ballots in good time. The thing, having done it once, the first questions I would ask in a situation like that are not so much about the paper, that's important. It's about what is your master list? What is your pool? What is your gold standard of eligibility? Despite these technical snafus at the beginning related to being unable to search in this census list, once we had cleaned it up a bit, and we cleaned it up not by making it read the diacriticals, by simply removing all diacritical marks. And so instead of question marks, we had a C. It just didn't have the thing on it. So we could train people to search for it without the diacritical marks, and you, more or less you would get it. That is what gave us confidence. If we didn't have that, I think it would have been much harder for us to make the leap of faith to ignore the regulations about having serial numbers and all of this stuff. Because there was documentation that existed from before the war, which we could compare people's claims. So if you're submitting to me an ID and it says you're a resident in Sarajevo, and I find your name on this list, I have a high confidence that you are entitled to vote in this election, as the electoral law is written. There's no place in Africa, really, where you're going to... Well, there's a few places, actually, where you could have those kinds of things. Rwanda now, I think, has a pretty computerized census of that nature. Hopefully, we never have to use it for this purpose. But, that was, in retrospect, such an important tool. And I later on, when we were trying to organize ourselves for the next to help thing, I found the guy who had been the chief demographer for the census. And he was this old retired guy outside of Split in Bosnia, or in Croatia. He had been the head of that census. And so I went to see him, and I still have the notes. I interviewed him for hours and hours just to understand, what it meant that a person, that this was there, and how he took it, how he registered. So a big problem, just as a thing, it wasn't clear whether guest workers, because there were a lot of Yugoslavian guest workers in Europe when the war started. They were trying to register to vote. Some of them were in the census, some of them weren't. And so the question arose, can we register them? Because I was able to find him, and I flew to Split and spent just 2 or 3 days in his house, time we didn't have. But, it was so important to understand the mechanics of this thing. That tool made it possible for us to enfranchise many more people than would have if you... And when you, in a situation where people don't even have, probably don't even have identity documents... You just have to think of this in other ways, social forms of validating identity and eligibility. People come and swear affidavits. There's different techniques you could use, or you can just take a simple one. If you are, it's probably what I would recommend. If you are registered as, say, a Chadian in a UNHCR camp for Chadians, that's good enough. If you were registered by a certain date, because probably they weren't infiltrating people into camps to register and live a miserable life as Chadians for the sole purpose of voting. But so you're going to have to get figuring out what is your sort of amulet of eligibility, is crucial to enable people to make rapid decisions in the field under extreme time pressure about, because you can't, I mean, if you, with all these election things, if you have to refer it back for decisions up and down, it's not that kind of thing. You have to have tools which enable people in the field to make decisions with confidence and some consistency. Because you don't have time, there's just no margin of error. It's always tight, and it's always a thing. And so that's one thing I thought was good about what we were able to push this decision-making fairly far down, because we had come up with this jerry-rigged masking tape system, which made it hard. If you had these two or three pieces of evidence, you had a compelling case, and we were confident that even if anyone audited it and looked at it, they would, a fair-minded person would come to the, would see that it had been as inclusive as it possibly could be, but that we hadn't actually compromised much in terms of security and the integrity of the vote. There's really, unless there was an agent, unless we had one agent in there who was really working for someone who was registering people, even though they weren't in the list and weren't on the thing. But like, that's one agent. How many could he do? We just got these piles of registration things. He couldn't know. It was just, luck of the draw. We got handed them out. It would have been very difficult to mount any kind of, because it was so decentralized, mount any kind of concerted effort to influence the vote through our process, mostly because we were so disorganized.
I'm interested in the degree to which the limited engagement of the hierarchy in the international community gave you the space,
yes,
to make this work. And that may not be something that's always replicable or that people would tolerate. And I'm curious about the story behind this. Why do you think that you had that leeway in this instance?
I the rest of my life is spoiled because my first sort of like job or activity of this kind was it was so special and so unusual. And it's not at all normal that you have a numbered bank account with $2 million for which there's no further accounting procedures than two people say, oh yeah. And it's not normal that you can, you have someone who's leading you who just hears and then acts. And Bill Hyde did that. He was focused on the results, and that's what he inculcated in all of us, and that empowered us to be similarly sort of decisive. And he's one of the best bosses I've ever worked for. I mean, it's just given me a model of how you manage a team in a fast-paced, totally unpredictable environment where he can't tell you a procedure or rule. He needs to give you guidelines to make your decisions, because even though he was sitting in the office from there, there was literally maybe 15 minutes during the day when we were both not on the phone. We would go to lunch usually, but it was like that. So there's no way to micromanage. In a way, I think technologies today make it easier for managers to micromanage, and even make it so that they would be derelict if they didn't try and micromanage. And I think in almost all cases, it makes things worse. Our decisions, maybe his leadership, his vision, but our decisions were also driven by the technological options available to us. If I had to do something like this again, I would do my best to try and have it be outside the main institution with its, get someone its own financing, because without a doubt, because every time I had to go deal with, because there was, the irony is, OSCE World Headquarters is where? In Vienna, in this old Viennese palace on the Ring. And so once in a while I would have to go there for something, and it was always with great trepidation, because we just didn't want them taking too keen an interest in what we were doing and, under their letterhead and so forth from this funny little office in another part of town. I'm sure they would have been horrified. I mean, luckily we had the full support of the Austrian government, because at one time there were threats against us and threats against the office, bomb threats. And so Jonas, I think, knew exactly who to call, and within half an hour, there were like Austrian paramilitaries on the block in the stairwell, and they remained there till the end of the election. So we didn't even need the OSCE headquarters for that kind of thing. But if we had to deal, every time I went there, like to get, oh, I remember, I had to go because you could get these laissez-passer things, which were alleged to facilitate travel, although I never saw much benefit. Well, maybe it helped with a visa or two. And so to go deal with like the ID person and get it, like, it took me 2 days because, but you're not in the system and so forth. Imagine you had to do that. And so the reason we were able to do it is because the Swiss foreign minister was our ultimate boss, really. And the Swiss government, this was the Swiss government's own money, which they were spending in order to make their chairmanship of the OSCE as successful as possible. And so the Swiss general, so it was a relationship between Flavio Cotti, who was the foreign minister, and General Arbenz. It was the Swiss government putting money under the custody of a distinguished Swiss citizen. What we actually were an operational unit of the Swiss government operating under the brand name of the OSCE. And because we were sort of created by the chairman, even though we had no formal legal attachment to the rest of the OSCE, and we had our own Swiss money, no one ever questioned whether what we were doing was authorized. Because Cotti said to Froick and Arbenz was there, so he just sort of created this impression, oh yeah, this is what's supposed to happen. And we were known to be attached. And for example, when I became the country representative in Croatia, I knocked on the door of the Swiss embassy and was issued a Swiss diplomatic vehicle with Swiss diplomatic license plates for my own use, and I drove around. I drove all the way down to Dubrovnik in that thing. That's how we were able to create this sort of protected zone. Even within that, we weren't... Flavio Cotti just wanted it to be seen to be done. And he got reports at some interval, I'm sure, from Arbenz. But we weren't checking things with Cotti. We were barely checking things with Arbenz, because he was in Switzerland, and he would come and we would have meetings. But day to day, it was Bill, me and Gerda, and then that was that. But it was because we had this, I guess you could say, diplomatic protection, and because no one knew about us, that we were able to do what we did.
But somebody in the country found, or some interested party did find out more about what you were doing because you had a security threat, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Because by that point, like everyone knew the address because we were accepting some mail because we didn't have to set the DHL thing, so people could send us the registration forms just to the address of the building. It didn't occur to us that would cause problems. So the fax number was of ICMPD, and so, mm-hmm. People found out about the building.
So I know we have to wrap up. Mm-hmm. I have one last question for now, and that is, how old were you?
I was 19.
Thank you.